from WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new movie Shattered Glass is based on the story of Stephen Glass, a staff writer at the New Republic who was one of journalism's rising stars, until his editor, with the help of a journalist from another publication, discovered that Glass was concocting quotes, making up sources, and in some cases, fabricating the whole story. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk to Charles Lane, the editor who uncovered Glass. Lane now reports on the Supreme Court for the Washington Post. And we'll talk with the actor who portrays Lane in Shattered Glass, Peter Sarsgaard. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD from tenor saxophonist Johnny Griffin and pianist Horace Parlan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A Virginia jury has convicted John Allen Muhammad of murder in the sniper killings that terrorized the Washington, D.C. area last fall. Vijay Walakar, the brother of one sniper victim, said Muhammad should face the death penalty.
I know that we cannot bring my brother back, but I think he should be punished for what he did. And so do the, you know, he killed so many other people.
Muhammad was found guilty of one murder and of taking part in multiple murders with his teenage companion, Lee Boyd Malveau. California's new governor has already begun filling some of his campaign promises. Arnold Schwarzenegger went to work after taking the oath of office today in Sacramento. John Myers of member station KQED has more.
In a speech of both symbolism and specifics, Arnold Schwarzenegger says the recall of now former governor Gray Davis was a veto of politics as usual. And he told the almost 10,000 in attendance that his election as governor of California was a reminder of the power of the people.
I enter this office beholden to no one except you, my fellow citizens. I pledge my governorship to your interest, not to special interests.
Governor Schwarzenegger immediately went to work after the ceremony outside California's state capitol by signing an executive order to repeal the unpopular increase in the state's car tax. For NPR News, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
2,000 striking transit mechanics have agreed to go back to work under a tentative agreement with the Los Angeles Metropolitan Transportation Authority. The agreement ends a 35-day strike that left more than 400,000 commuters without public transportation. The influential senior group AARP has endorsed the Medicare deal reached by House and Senate negotiators this weekend. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
AARP CEO Bill Novelli said his group still has problems with some aspects of the bill, but enough has been changed to win his group's support.
I would simply say that now the bill is at a stage where it is worthy of bipartisan support.
AARP backing is a major coup for Republicans who've been courting the group all year. AARP now plans a major lobbying and advertising campaign to help get the final version of the measure through the House and Senate before Thanksgiving. But the bill is far from a done deal. Most Democrats and most other senior groups oppose it. They say the drug benefit is too small and changes aimed at slowing Medicare spending are too radical. Conservative House members are also voicing doubts. They're worried the new drug benefit's cost could spiral out of control. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 57 points to close at 97.10 in active trading. The Nasdaq was down 20 points, just over 1%, to close at 19.09. This is NPR News. Israeli officials discussed European Union complaints that Israel has snubbed the EU's Middle East peace envoy. Douglas Bakshin reports from Luxembourg City.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and other senior officials have refused to meet the new EU envoy formally since he met with Yasser Arafat in September. An EU statement drafted for an EU-Israel Association Council meeting strongly criticized the Jewish state's tactic of cold-shouldering those who talk with Arafat. Israeli Foreign Minister Silvan Shalom today met with several EU foreign ministers individually, and an Israeli diplomat said afterwards, Israel is ready to allow the EU envoy to meet with officials of his own rank. The two-day EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels is dominated by the Middle East conflict, Iran's nuclear program, and security in Iraq. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Bakshin in Luxembourg City.
President Bush invited five Iraqi women to the White House today to help underscore his message that U.S. forces will not withdraw from Iraq after a provisional government takes office next summer. He told reporters that he had assured the women the U.S. will stay. He added that Iraq has become a new front in the war on terror.
That's precisely what the terrorists want to do, is to try to drive us out of Iraq before these leaders and other leaders are able to put their government together and live in peace. And we will succeed.
U.S. forces launched an offensive today against suspected insurgent hideouts around Tikrit, the home region of ousted Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. The operations came after the broadcast of a taped speech purported to be from Saddam. It called for more attacks against U.S. troops and their allies. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Shattered Glass, is based on the story of Stephen Glass, a staff writer for the New Republic who was considered one of journalism's rising young stars. He reported on light and serious stories that no one else was getting, including bad behavior at a conference of young conservatives and a clandestine meeting of anti-Clinton activists. It turned out there was a reason no one else had these stories. Some were partially fabricated, others were completely made up. 27 of his 41 stories for the New Republic contain fabrications. Shattered Glass tells the story of how Glass was uncovered in 1998 by a journalist at the online magazine Forbes Digital Tool and by Glass's editor at the New Republic, Charles Lane. A little later, we'll hear from Peter Sarsgaard, who portrays Lane in the movie. First, we'll talk with Lane himself. He now covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. Let's start with a scene from early in the film when Lane was still a reporter at the New Republic and the editor was Michael Kelly, played in the movie by Hank Azaria. The staff is at an editorial meeting. Reporters are pitching story ideas. Glass has a very amusing story.
Every station on the radio is talking about it. Mike Tyson biting Evander Holyfield. And these are supposed to be news stations. So on Tuesday, I started calling a few of them, and I finally got through to one, a Bible talk station in Kentucky. And I managed to convince the screener that I was a behavioral psychologist who specializes in human-on-human biting. I told the guy that I'd done all this extensive research on people who chomp flesh under extreme stress.
What did they say?
They put me on the air. I took calls for 45 minutes.
Oh, my God.
Why does he find these people? It's kind of stupid. I know. It's silly. I'll probably just kill it.
Okay, moving right along. Chuck, what do you have for us?
Oh, it's a bit of a hard act to follow. Very hard act to follow. Okay. I'm starting the piece on Haiti. And I'm going to be going down to Port-au-Prince for a few days.
Uh-huh. That's a scene from the new film, Shattered Glass. Charles Lane, welcome to Fresh Air. Was this an accurate representation of editorial pitch meetings? Did Stephen Glass sound kind of like that when he was making pitches, and were they as fantastic?
Yeah, I think so. I have to concede that this particular one that we just heard didn't quite take place. It's kind of a compression of a couple of different ones. But yeah, he had this kind of really engaging way of pitching these stories, and everybody looked forward to hearing what he would come up with next because they were always so colorful. It seemed like Steve had some kind of a gift or blessing that put him in the middle of a life that was much more interesting than everyone else's.
And did you feel the way I think you're described as feeling in the movie, that your story about Haiti seems so drab by comparison?
Not really. Like I say, that kind of immediate contrast never really occurred. In fact, that story about Haiti was assigned to me by Michael Kelly when he was still the editor. So I actually thought the Haiti story was kind of cool, but and involved a trip for 2 weeks to a Caribbean country and a lot of reporting. So but I do think that what they're trying to get across in the movie is the sense that not just me, but a lot of other people on the staff were wondering, like, what's the value of our kind of regular mundane reporting when it seems that, you know, all these zany and colorful pieces that Steve Glass is coming up with are what really attract all the attention.
Did you ever think these stories are too good to be true?
Well, I've thought about that so much looking back, because for a large part of Steve's really his rise at the New Republic, I was actually not physically present at the New Republic, because sort of from about September of 96 to about July of 97, I was away on a fellowship at Yale Law School. So I was more or less reading this stuff from a distance, you know. And a lot of them struck me, I remember, as thinking, like, this isn't really the kind of story the New Republic does, you know, because they seemed sort of, sometimes they were almost kind of crude. But I have to admit that, you know, seeing them one after another and knowing that there were editors and other people in the New Republic who were supposedly responsible for checking these, I didn't think that they could be completely fake. In fact, I didn't think they were even partially fake. You know, it's sort of that mystique that the words printed on paper acquire. And I took them, like everyone else, pretty much at face value, which now I have to say I'm really embarrassed by, that I wasn't the one really to find out right away.
Let me read one of the stories that Stephen Glass wrote that was published in the New Republic in February of 1998. It's called Plotters. When Hillary Clinton started ranting last week about a vast right-wing conspiracy, Beltway pundits could barely suppress their snickers. The First Lady seemed to be implying that somewhere in America there is a committee of middle-aged white men who regularly get together, hunch around a long oval table, and feverishly plot to undermine the Clinton administration. Does Mrs. Clinton really believe this malarkey? Does anyone? Actually, I do. Last Sunday, just such a meeting took place, and I was there. It was the monthly gathering of the Commission to Restore the Presidency to Greatness, or CRPG. And the scene unfolded exactly as the First Lady might have expected. The clandestine rendezvous took place in Northern Virginia at the rural home of software developer R. Theodore Curtis. The attendees were all middle-aged white men dressed in sober ties and starched dress shirts. Most had receding hairlines. Sitting on the table in front of each man was a name card listing his title and area of responsibility. Vice President for Vince Foster's Death Affairs. Special Counsel to Investigate Filegate. Deputy Inspector for Arkansas Issues, and so on. Was this story completely fabricated, Chuck Lane?
I think so. I think it was. And I'm trying to remember anything I can about how we edited it and fact-checked it. I'm just not really able to recall the process at that time. But yeah, that was a completely fabricated story. I mean, one thing, as I listen to you read it, it reminds me of are some of the elements of Steve's con, you know, that enabled it to go on for so long. One is the fact that the New Republic was an opinion magazine to begin with. So there, any story that was done in the magazine was allowed to have a certain voice and opinion. It's not a straight news publication. So that's one thing you can sort of see he's taking advantage of there. Secondly, he always seemed to be going to things that were happening in secret, you know, in basements, among the members of a peculiar subculture, you know, so that it would be very hard for anyone to second guess him, anyone who assumed that he was a legitimate reporter, because you wouldn't really know yourself too much independently about this. And thirdly, and I think crucially, he works with stereotypes. You can see it in the middle-aged white man, you know, that he, and this is present in so many of his fake stories, and I think is really, to me, has been the really sobering lesson of this whole episode, was how the ability to put these stories over not only on editors but readers depended on the use of cliche and stereotype, knowing that in a way he was providing people with something not exactly that they wanted to hear, but that they were well prepared to hear. You know what I mean? And I think this story really illustrates that.
Do you think the story actually did real damage because it made up this, like, actual conspiracy? Actual conspiracy against Clinton.
Well, this is what's so amazing about Steve's career, is that a lot of these stories were fake, but maybe could have been real. I mean, there is a group now, the Free Republic group, I think you've heard of them, that which is, you know, sort of like the one Steve is talking about. Additionally, the Hack Heaven story, which he was his last one, was about teenage hackers who were supposedly extorting money from the companies that they hacked into. And it turned out a couple years later, my own newspaper now, The Washington Post, did a story about Russian teenage hackers who had hacked into companies and were extorting money from them. They were caught, you know, by the FBI, and the story is true, and there are pictures and everything to prove it. But I'm just saying that in a way, Steve, in addition to all the other things I just described, he had a knack for finding things that were just crazy enough to be true.
My guest is journalist Charles Lane. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charles Lane. He was the editor at The New Republic who uncovered the fabrications of reporter Stephen Glass. That story is told in the new movie, Shattered Glass. Let's talk about the story that you worked on that really uncovered Stephen Glass and his fabrications. This was a story called Hack Heaven. What was the story about?
Well, basically, it was about, it wasn't a very long story. It was about 1,300 words, and it described a young man of 15 years named Ian Restel, who was supposed to be a Russian immigrant who had learned how to hack into computers of big software companies, and he had hacked into one company's computer. The company was supposed to be called Juked Micronics, and posted all kinds of stuff on their website and then shaken them down for money so that he would stop, and that he supposedly had an agent and that he was part of a group of people who were doing this called the National Assembly of Hackers, and that this was becoming such a problem that states were considering legislation to stop it, and et cetera, et cetera. Again, you know, I have to, as I look back on it, it's the most perfectly ridiculous thing I've ever heard. On the other hand, you know, once it came across my desk after being across two other people's desks and in the rush of that week's business, I looked at it and I thought, okay, it's a pretty clever story and let's get it in the magazine. I'm really sorry about that. The only thing I'm not sorry about in a way is that this one was so outrageous that another news organization, Forbes Digital Tool, which was the website of Forbes magazine, wanted to somehow try and match this story because they felt they'd been scooped. And they went and started to look at it, and they called me when they couldn't find anything to back it up. And at that point, I thought, gee, you know, these guys really have made a good case that there's something wrong with this story, and I began to look into it myself.
Now, in the movie, when you get called by Forbes Digital Tool, your first reaction is to defend your writer, Stephen Glass. Did you feel that as an editor, that your first job was to defend him?
I actually felt very conflicted, because when Adam Pennenberg of Forbes called me and laid out in some detail what he had been unable to document in Steve's story, I immediately thought it could be a fabrication. At least I was open to that possibility. Whereas I think Adam and the people at Forbes were actually thinking maybe Steve himself had been duped by somebody. In any case, I called Martin Peretz, who was and still is the owner of The New Republic, and I told him what had happened, and I said, I'm going to look into this, and I want you to know that if it turns out that it was fabricated, we'll have to fire him.
At what point did you call him into your office and start questioning him about it? How much research did you want to do independently before calling him in? And how much did you want to just call him in first before you did any research?
Well, I brought him in right away. Mm-hmm. As I remember it, he wasn't at the New Republic, you know, physically when this happened.
Uh-huh.
But I called him in right away, and I think he came in from home. And his reaction was very strange, because the first thing he said was, what did I do? You know, did I do something wrong? And I said to him, well, you need to get all the phone numbers. I explained to him what Forbes was doing. And I said, you need to bring me all the phone numbers and information for how to contact all these people, in the story. And what he came back with was a bunch of phone numbers. He would kind of gradually get one after another that turned out to be voicemails for the people who ostensibly existed, you know, these people in his story. And as that evening went on and I called these voicemails and didn't get anyone calling me back, and the voicemails themselves had very strange voices on them and that sort of thing, I began to realize this was very fishy. And it was my wife who pointed out to me by going through the Yellow Pages that there are these services that you can call that will allow you to set up a voicemail anywhere in the country under almost any area code, you know. And it was clear that he had just faked these voicemail boxes. But I realized that this is the kind of charge. If you're gonna be suspecting somebody of fabricating, you have to prove it. You know, you can't just level that charge without proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That was the way I approached it, because it's such a serious charge, and there's a presumption of innocence, right? So he then arranged to have his brother, unbeknownst to me, call me and represent himself as one of the people in this story. And when I heard an actual human voice purporting to be one of Steve's sources, I thought, wow, you know, there's reasonable doubt. Because, hey, here's sort of an actual person who seems to be real. And it wasn't until I discovered later that that person was his brother that all my reasonable doubt disappeared.
How did you figure that out?
Serendipitously, because late at night on the Friday, this all started on a Thursday afternoon, another editor of the magazine and I were talking about the situation on the phone, and she just kind of casually mentioned that Steve had a brother who lived in Palo Alto, and this is depicted in the movie. The phone number that he had given me for this software company was a Palo Alto phone number, and the voice I had heard on the phone had sounded oddly similar to Steve's. So I put two and two together, and the next morning I went into the New Republic, and Steve was there, apparently trying to, you know, get rid of some evidence that was in his computer. And I confronted him about it. And at first he denied that it was his brother. And then, again, as depicted in the movie, he fessed up. Yes, I had my brother pretend to be this person. And I did it because even though that person is real, I couldn't find him and I needed to buy some time, which was obviously not true. And that was the end of his career.
Did he try to play you? Did he try to manipulate you?
Absolutely. Every step of the way. And he tried everything. You know, that Thursday night, I repeat, it all began on a Thursday. He called me at home late at night, and he became kind of aggressive. He said, you know, Chuck, you're not backing me up. You're making me feel very attacked. You know, an editor is supposed to back people up. And he was trying to throw me on the defensive. And what I remember saying to him was, you know, Steve, I want to back you up, but I don't have enough to work with right now. You have to give me more to work with. And what that illustrates is that at every point I was trying to remain even-handed with him, at least never tip my hand about where I was heading with this and never become emotional, because I think he would have tried, I even somehow intuitively sensed then that he would try to exploit that. The next day when, you know, I took him out to that hotel and made him walk around the site of this alleged event, which also helped prove that it hadn't happened. And then we get into the car on the way back, and he broke down and he said, okay, I made up the conference and all the events in the story are real, but I made up the fact that I was there. I heard about it later and I made it seem in the article I was there. And then he said, but if you want me to say that I made the whole article up, I'll do that if it'll help you. And I saw that as a trap, you know, that he was going to try and make and do that and then say later that I'd coerced him into saying something that wasn't true. So I responded to him, no, Steve, I just want you to tell me what the truth is, you know. So he was at every moment, every step of the way, fighting to preserve his position at the magazine or whatever, to preserve his whole career. And he didn't hesitate to manipulate and lie.
Once you figured out, okay, this piece was a total fabrication, and a lot of other pieces were completely or partially fabricated as well, how did you figure out how to handle it. How to handle it with Glass was complicated but easy in the sense that you fire him. I mean, it's hard to do,
right.
You do it, you fire him. But how to discuss this to the public, to your readers, to the rest of the press, that's really, really hard. So what was your thought process like about how to reveal this information to the public?
Well, one thing I was had as like a bottom line principle was there would be no cover up, right? That we would never find out anything about this case from anybody else through the press. So I wanted us to break the whole story before anyone else. And my first step in that regard was on Sunday, May the 10th, I called up Howie Kurtz of the Washington Post, who covers the media, and I just laid out to him what we knew at that point and that we were firing Steve Glass, so that that would be out in the media before the Forbes story came out. That was step one. Then the follow-on step to that was we have to find out everything he did. You know, we have to completely investigate all of his stories and any other conduct, you know, that we might have to answer for and get that into the magazine as soon as possible. And furthermore, announce an apology for all of this and announce that we're going to investigate. So we did all that on Monday and Tuesday. And I thought one of the things that was good about that was that I involved the whole staff in this investigation of Steve's material. And I always felt that that gave some people something to do with their emotions at that time, you know, that everybody was feeling so lousy and so angry and everything else. This gave people something to channel that into, and we all kind of worked together on it. There is a part of all that, dealing with the media, though, that I sort of regret in hindsight. You know, I was so kind of worried about how we would be treated and didn't for a minute expect that people would actually appreciate the fact that we were doing this full disclosure, that I became initially somewhat defensive with some reporters who approached me. And in a couple of cases, I kind of just turned them away and said, I don't want to talk to you. And that was a real mistake, you know, and I think it was just a mistake I made at the beginning that I even now I sort of regret. And that's one reason ever since when I realized how bad it was not to be fully open with some people while being open with others, that I've always done interviews about this, because I just don't want, even now, I don't want anybody to say that, you know, there's some reluctance to discuss this.
Charles Lane is the editor at The New Republic who revealed the fabrications of the magazine's staff writer, Stephen Glass. The movie Shattered Glass is based on their story. Lane will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Art of the Bookplate, an illustrated history and celebration with a foreword by George Plimpton. Available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. By Starbucks, makers of eggnog lattes, peppermint mochas, and gingerbread lattes. Available this holiday season at Starbucks. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House Incorporated. Publisher of Sickened, the memoir of a Munchausen by proxy childhood by Julie Gregory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Charles Lane, the editor who discovered that Stephen Glass had fabricated stories that were published in The New Republic. We'll talk with Peter Sarsgaard, the actor who plays Lane in the new movie Shattered Glass. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD featuring Johnny Griffin and Horace Parlan.
Mm-hmm.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Charles Lane, the editor at The New Republic, who investigated a story by the staff writer Stephen Glass and found that Glass had fabricated the entire story. After Lane initiated a further evaluation of Glass's writing, The New Republic discovered that 27 of Glass's 41 pieces for the magazine contained fabrications. The new movie Shattered Glass tells the story of how Glass's lies were discovered. Charles Lane now covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. In June of 1998, The New Republic published a letter to its readers apologizing for the Stephen Glass fabrications and trying to explain as best as you could what happened. So I thought I'd read a short excerpt of that letter. How could this happen? It's a perfectly fair question. We've been asked it repeatedly since we informed the press of Glass's firing, and we expect to be confronted with it again and again. We are asking it of ourselves. The editors of The New Republic, like those of other magazines, have devised fact-checking procedures to ensure the accuracy of our copy. Generally, we believe our record in this regard has been a good one. Plainly, however, the precautions we took were not adequate to prevent Glass's fabrications from making it into print. We intend to find out why and to take corrective action where necessary. We editors take responsibility for the failures of discernment that permitted this false material to be published. But it is important to understand that our editing and fact-checking systems are designed to defend against the errors and mistakes even good professionals sometimes make, not against the systematic and intentional deceptions of someone who actually has no business practicing journalism. So that's an interesting distinction you make there, that fact-checking is for good journalists who kind of make a mistake, not for people who are intentionally liars and who are trying to manipulate the system.
Yeah, it's not fraud checking, as some people have said. And Steve really went to great lengths to deceive fact checkers, as has been noted before. You know, he made up false notes. He staged false voicemails, I later found out. He would occasionally invent documents. And so, you know, it was a pretty wide-ranging effort at deception. You know, I think one of the procedural things that was going on at the New Republic that made Steve possible was that he just happened to come along at a time when there was a lot of internal turmoil and transition among the editors of the New Republic. It was not a good time organizationally for the magazine. So he came on, I think, in late 95, and Andrew Sullivan was the editor. Andrew left the magazine and suddenly, you know, in the middle of 1996, and Michael Kelly was hired to replace him, but Mike, because he was under contract to the New Yorker, didn't come for about 6 months. So between about the middle of 96 and the end of 96, there was no editor of the New Republic. There was a series of sort of substitutes. And that was when Steve started writing more pieces. Then Mike Kelly came in. He only lasted for about 9 months. And of course, Steve really began to really take off in that 9 months. And then I came in, you know, and with each new editor, there would be new fact checkers and new kind of subordinate editors. And there was a tremendous amount of turnover. And therefore, hard for any one person to kind of track Steve Glass through that. And I think he really exploited that kind of vacuum of authority. In addition, you know, the New Republic had had problems prior to this with another journalist called Ruth Shalit, who had plagiarized some material and had been suspended and, you know, really created kind of a black mark on the magazine. And I think a lot of the editors were focused on making sure, you know, that Ruth Shalit was performing up to snuff. And, you know, that kind of distracted attention from what anybody else, including Steve, might be doing. So it's very unfortunate, you know, that this, I think, reflects also that it was kind of a just a rough and tumble and uncertain and disorganized time at the New Republic generally, which kind of, I think, unbeknownst to anyone, created a climate that Steve could exploit.
Did you make any changes in the fact-checking system after the Stephen Glass story?
Yes. We developed a whole new written policy. We sort of cracked down on the use of unnamed sources and a lot of other things. But I have to say two things about that. Fact-checking at the New Republic is never going to be like fact-checking at a place like The New Yorker or Newsweek that are sort of like really big organizations with a lot of resources and large staffs. And The New Republic is a very small, low-budget magazine that never, I think, has ever had more than three people fact-checking, say, 20 stories a week. That's just a reality. And so there are going to be limits on it. And even, I believe very firmly, that even the most sophisticated fact-checking system would be hard-pressed to stop certain kinds of journalistic fraud. The New York Times Magazine, which is an outstanding magazine with great fact-checking, has recently had to disavow the reporting of one of its people who had created a false composite character in a story. So there is no procedural fix, Terry, to the problem of a fraudulent journalist, because if somebody, for whatever purpose, is intent on doing it, they'll figure out the fact-checking system and find where its holes are and then try to exploit the holes.
Well, Stephen Glass was a fact-checker for a brief time at The New Yorker, so he knew the system.
Well, at the New Republic,
at the New Republic. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, Steve had been a fact checker and was known as a very thorough and rigorous one, which was all part of his scam, you know, because another reason people didn't suspect his own work was that he ostensibly was so concerned about facts. He was entrusted with that responsibility, quite mistakenly, of course.
If there were warning signs about Stephen Glass before he was actually uncovered, what were those signs?
Well, a number of times people wrote letters to the editor, not while I was editor that I recall, but prior to that, a number of letters to the editor were written where people said, this just didn't happen, it's not true. And, I think that was looked into, and Steve, came up with a lie that seemed to account for it, and, people moved on. So that's very unfortunate. But again, I go back to this. It's very hard to make this charge, Terry. It's very hard to go to somebody and say, you know what? I think you might have fabricated. Prove to me that you didn't. Because it's such a serious charge, you know. It's like accusing a priest of, violating his vows of whatever, poverty and obedience. It goes so to the heart of the profession that unless you feel very strongly you have the evidence, you don't initially make it.
Are there specific examples of how the fact-checking process has been changed?
Well, you have to remember, I haven't been there since 1999, so I don't know what they're doing right now. But yeah. I can comment on what happened when I was there.
Sure.
And absolutely, I can remember specific cases where, for example, we got a report from a freelancer in Kosovo, I think. And that person was telling us that such and such a person didn't want her name used, a person in Kosovo, right? And therefore couldn't be quoted by name. But we insisted that she give us a name and address, I believe, for that person in Kosovo before we would use the unnamed quote, so that we would have some, even though we wouldn't use the person's name, we would know what it was. And that was pursuant to a policy we developed that whenever you use an unnamed quote, you would have to supply the name to at least one editor, so that there'd be some other person who would know that the person was real. And we took a lot of precautions like that. And frankly, we challenged a number of people who weren't too happy to be challenged, but we felt we had to do it, you know.
Have you seen Stephen Glass again since firing him?
The only time I saw Steve was a brief glimpse of him across a room when I went for a visit to his lawyer when I was still editor of the New Republic, and I haven't seen him since.
He's writing again. How do you feel about that?
Well, I didn't appreciate his book, his novel, which I felt really kind of contradicted his expressions of remorse, because the book portrays not only me but other people who were responsible for unmasking him in a very, very negative light. Obviously, it's a roman à clef. We're not named, but we're also not fools, and we know what's based, who these characters are based on. And so I was troubled when I read it, because he has been now going public and saying how much remorse he feels and sending out letters of apology and that sort of thing. But the book, I think, once again shows the kind of nasty side of Stephen Glass and shows that he seems to have this need, when he's fictionalizing, to create people who are to be made fun of or are to be viewed in a negative light.
He's writing journalism again, too, isn't he? I think he's writing for the Rolling Stone again.
I think he wrote one article for them, yeah. And, caveat emptor.
Charles Lane is the editor at the New Republic who revealed the fabrications of the magazine staff writer Stephen Glass. Lane now covers the Supreme Court for the Washington Post. The movie Shattered Glass is based on the story of Stephen Glass. Coming up, we hear from the actor who portrays Charles Lane in the movie, Peter Sarsgaard. This is Fresh Air. In the new movie Shattered Glass, my guest Peter Sarsgaard plays Charles Lane, who we just heard from. Lane was the editor at the New Republic who discovered that the magazine's reporter Stephen Glass had been fabricating stories. Here's another scene from Shattered Glass. Lane suspects that Glass's latest story is at least partially made up. Lane confronts Glass at the office and insists that they retrace the steps Glass took when he was allegedly covering the story and track down his sources. Time is of the essence because the online magazine Forbes Digital Tool has been investigating Glass's story and discovered fabrications within it. Glass is played by Hayden Christensen.
We need to take a drive to Bethesda.
What for?
I want to meet Joe Hired.
I already told you, nobody knows where he is.
Well, maybe if we go to the hotel where he met with Restles and Sims, someone will remember him.
Chuck,
or have
there
some
are
clue
hundreds
as how to find
of
him.
People there, okay?
These Forbes guys want to come down on you. They're highly suspicious about some of the material in that article. You know that.
Yeah.
But they're going to go online with their piece tomorrow.
Oh.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, Steve. Steve.
Yeah.
If we can find Hired, I can back him off for a day or two. Okay?
Okay, I'll get my notes.
Okay.
Peter Sarsgaard, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
This is a good scene.
Yeah, I like that clip, actually.
I did, too.
I like that clip because it's in a two-shot. You get to see the two of us acting together. They're my favorite.
Is that unusual?
It is unusual. You know, it's unusual. It's more unusual in a bigger budget film. In a smaller budget film, they're trying to save time. So a shot like that sort of saves having to shoot three other shots. You know, two close-ups and maybe another tighter two. But I like them. It sort of empowers the actor. Because we can act together. It can't be cut.
Well, that's one of the problems of movies, isn't it? That sometimes you're not acting together?
Oh, so frequently. So frequently you're acting looking at the corner of a lens or something like that. But really, the bigger the budget, it gets more technical because people have more time to do fancy shots. I think that was, you know, what was compelling about doing this movie.
One of the things I like about the movie is that it's really just about the journalistic story. There isn't, like, love stories brought in. There isn't, like, a murderer lurking in the background.
Right.
The only mystery is, what is true, what is false, and what is the motivation for the fabrication?
Yeah.
You're playing a real person, Charles Lane. What is necessary for you to do in terms of casting? I mean, when you're playing Charles Lane, did you have to look like Charles Lane? Did you have to talk like Charles Lane?
No. I mean, I've played, quote-unquote, real people a number of times. I mean, Boys Don't Cry was a real person. Actually, the character that I played in K-19 was even a real person. I mean, if they're not in the public eye, if you're not playing Nixon, there's really no value in impersonating them because the audience has no expectation about who they're seeing. But I did talk to him some beforehand.
What did you talk about? What did you feel you should find out from him?
His perspective on the actual events that happened. Not so much who Chuck Lane was, but what Chuck Lane thought happened. You know, Michael Kelly has his version of events, and Chuck Lane has his version of events, and Stephen Glass has his version of events, and, you know, the only difference between all three of them is that Michael Kelly and Chuck Lane were, their intention was to perceive what actually happened, you know. But even that said, you know, objective truth is an impossible thing. So I wanted to find out what Chuck Lane thought happened.
Did you read back editions of The New Republic? Did you read any of the Stephen Glass stories?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, Billy gave us all packets, you know, and I did. I read a number of them. I also read a number of Chuck Lane's pieces. The thing about Stephen Glass's pieces is once you know that he made them up, once you have that in your mind, it's very easy to see that they're fictitious. You know, I mean, they're absurd. They're really, really, really absurd. One thing that I think is interesting is, and this is sort of peripheral to the movie, is that Stephen Glass wrote a piece for Rolling Stone also during this time. You know, and he also wrote pieces for George. But the piece that he wrote for Rolling Stone ended up getting Rolling Stone sued. And they won the case. But Stephen Glass is now writing for Rolling Stone, like as of, I don't know, 6 months ago or something like that. He wrote a piece about marijuana laws in Canada. I just think it's interesting that, not just that this guy lied, but that everybody wants to believe him all the time, so much so that we're willing to give him another job and believe him, try to believe him again. You know, we're consumers of media, and this guy puts out an interesting product, I think is what the movie is basically about.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Sarsgaard. He stars in the new movie Shattered Glass, which is based on the true story of journalist Stephen Glass, who, it turns out, fabricated a lot of the stories that he wrote for the New Republic and other publications. Sarsgaard plays Charles Lane, who at the time was the editor of the New Republic. One of the things I like about the movie is that it's, you know, often in movies about journalism, there's this, like, torrid romance and, you know, all this kind of, like, extracurricular stuff that's very Hollywood. This movie really sticks to the journalism story. And in a way, it doesn't give you a lot to play in the sense that, you know, no one's coming at you with a gun. You know, you're not getting into bed with a leading lady. You're just, you know, you're just a new editor in a difficult position who's unsure of yourself. And in a position of having to do something very distasteful, which is like investigate one of your own writers and in the end try to unmask him. Can you talk about the difficulties of playing somebody, you know, that is in a situation like that, which isn't necessarily the stuff of big Hollywood films?
Yeah, I know what you mean. The difficulty in playing this role was that the whole first half is silent, basically. You know, I'm accumulating details and facts. I'm being a reporter, basically. Not that I suspect him. Not that I suspect he's made everything up at the beginning of the movie, but I suspect something, and I suspect enough so that I start paying attention to him, and I have to arrive at a point later in the movie where I've accumulated enough facts and details and I'm willing to actually say something to him. Because, you know, for most of the movie, I can't say anything to him because if someone knows that they're being studied, they're not, or, you know, watched, they're going to start protecting what they say a little bit more. You know, it's Forbes that's after him. It's not me that's after him. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that Billy did that really helped me and that I've never had a director do before is he got interested when I was not talking in the first part of the movie. And, you know, I could have thought the thoughts and, you know, a lot of what I do in the movie is think one thing is true and then hear him say something and decide that's not true and, you know, formulate a new theory. And, you know, a lot of it's kind of complicated. And so what Billy did was he just put the camera in a position for a lot of those scenes where you'd be able to see my thoughts and where I wouldn't have to kind of telegraph them to the audience, which you're asked to do quite a bit as an actor. But Billy would just keep moving the camera around until he could read my thoughts better.
If, for example, you look kind of skeptical at a editorial meeting where Stephen Glass is pitching this really elaborate story, there's times when you just look... You look troubled. You look reluctant
yeah.
to take action. So how do you, what goes through your mind when you have to register something, when something like that has to register on your face, but you're not trying to, you know, quote, telegraph the emotion?
Yeah, well, you know, luckily there are many different sides to Hayden Christensen in the movie, so I just deal with whatever he's doing, you know. I mean, but it is complicated because it's not... With this role, a lot of parts that I've played a lot of kind of chaotic people, and whatever chaos happened was always good. This movie, Billy really, it was kind of a tightrope feeling. He, you know, I wanted to believe as an actor playing some of the scenes some of the time that he had made everything up, that, you know, what I was seeing was the complete fabrication that it looked like it was. But that doesn't help your movie if I think that for the entire movie. So, you know, you start coming up with different theories about what's going on. You think somebody might have duped this guy, you know, like he got a little bit of disinformation, put it in his piece, and now he's beating himself up about it because he seems like that kind of guy. Or you go, no, it seems like it might be bigger, or it seems like it's nothing. I mean, I tried to, and Billy really helped me with this, let each one of those theories have its day in the movie,
mm-hmm.
And not necessarily in an ascending order to believing that he had made everything up, you know, not like a clear trajectory toward that.
Peter Sarsgaard plays editor Charles Lane in the new film Shattered Glass. Sometime in the next few days, we'll hear more from Sarsgaard, who also starred in Boys Don't Cry and K-19 and got his start in the film Dead Man Walking. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new collaboration between tenor saxophonist Johnny Griffin and pianist Horace Parlan. This is Fresh Air. Tenor saxophonist Johnny Griffin and pianist Horace Parlan worked together in New York in the 1960s. Griffin then moved to Europe, eventually settling in France, but they renewed their acquaintance after Parlan moved to Denmark in the 1970s. In 2000, they recorded a duo album, which is now out in the States. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it brings out a different side of Johnny Griffin.
Johnny Griffin prides himself on fast thinking and fast fingers. He'll take on any rival soloist at the quickest tempo a band can handle. Pianist Horace Parlan is no jackrabbit, favoring slow, deliberate tempos and a self-effacing solo style. These old friends make an odd couple, but the match is less a problem than opportunity for Griffin, who accepts Parlan's terms. The hare slows down to hang with the tortoise. Thank you. Johnny Griffin and Horace Parlin from their album Close Your Eyes on Minor Music. Griffin has recorded ballads before. Fast beboppers like to slow way down and tough tenors to get tender. But this is almost Griffin for lovers, recalling the peaceful ballads John Coltrane cut in the 60s. The duo play two tunes associated with them, My One and Only Love and Billy Strayhorn's My Little Brown Book. Griffin never tries to sound like Coltrane, but there are some twinges of Stan Getz. Griffin sounds great at that tempo, which lets us hear his warm, round sound up close. He displays his usual taste and intelligence, but changing the context can change the meaning of what he plays. In a fast solo, his habit of quoting from lullabies, bugle calls, fiddle tunes, Broadway songs, and light classics comes off smart-alecky. Here he does it less, and there's something wistful or melancholy about those snippets as they float by, like doghouses in a flood. The CD Close Your Eyes is subtitled Johnny Griffin Meets Horace Parlin. Not for the first time, but the way you meet a friend on the street and invite him over for a drink. It's no big event, but sometimes a quiet evening beats a loud.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, The Absolute Sound, and Downbeat. He reviewed the CD Close Your Eyes by Johnny Griffin and Horace Parlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeldt. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video and JFK, two-disc special edition, a film by Oliver Stone, including Beyond JFK, The Question of Conspiracy, now available, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Charles Sennett talks with us about his recent return trip to Iraq after covering the war, and we'll talk about the relationship between President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair, who are about to meet in London. Sennett is the London bureau chief for the Boston Globe. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.